Good afternoon. Last time, we started by moving on from discussing how Xv6 handles system calls to talking about other kinds of exceptions. And they shared a lot of the same code as far as how we got into the kernel and, you know, our first entry point, that trap function. But after that, we did different things, basically just depending on what the exception was for. It was for I/O, we need to do something with the I/O device. If it was a timer, we'd think about whether we wanted to switch to a different program, and so on. Then we went into how we actually switch to different programs in Xv6. And Xv6 used this strategy where each, you know, thread in user space had a corresponding kernel stack, and we switched between from one kernel stack to the other. And by when doing this, we were taking advantage of our exception handling code to save the user registers. That the user registers were saved in the kernel stack, and by switching from one kernel stack to the other, we switched the set of user registers that were active at the time, because they would be restored later on when we returned from the current exception. So we talked about our main switch function, which needed to be written in assembly just because there's no way in C to like actually change stack pointers. And it would basically just save everything we needed to save on the stack, switch to the other stack, and restore things that were previously saved in that other thread. In addition, there were some extra details. We mentioned that the user part was handled with the trap entry and exit. We also had to deal with address spaces, which we'll talk about a lot more, like basically halfway through the semester, which is another part of that switch operation. So questions about this before we talk about, move on to our topics today about managing processes. So one detail that we were missing when we were talking about this context switch operation is that, as we had things before, we switched to another thread, and we switched to a place where the thread had already called switch previously. And this is missing a piece because we need a way of starting threads. Okay. You know, when a thread starts, it won't have already called switch. So how do we deal with that? So, you know, we needed information on that stack that would have been placed there from a call to switch. And the trick we used to deal with that, in Xv6 at least, is that we set up the initial stack of the thread as if it were in the middle of a call to switch. We put the same things on the stack that would have been put by a call to switch there, so it's ready to switch to. This avoids sort of an alternate possible implementation where we'd have like two versions of switch, one to switch to a thread which has already started, and one to switch to a thread which is just starting. And instead, we just use that one piece of code. So the code to do this in Xv6 is in a function called allocproc, allocproc for allocate process. It's process and not thread because in Xv6, each process has exactly one thread. And when this function is called, there's first, before the code I'm showing you, a kernel stack is allocated. And this code here is going to construct an artificial contents of that kernel stack, starting with the top of the stack. So it has this stack pointer variable, which is sort of a virtual stack pointer for filling in the new stack. So initially, we set the stack pointer to point to the top of that kernel stack, where it was going to start, and because of how x86 works, it's going to grow towards lower addresses. And then we allocate space on that stack by decrementing our stack pointer for the new stack to include space for a trap frame. This is the set of saved registers that are going to be used when we return from the trap function, or in this case, we pretend to return from the trap function. Now, so we have this user registers that we're going to restore and then return from the exception when we switch to this program. And we need to run that code, which is going to restore those registers and return from the exception. And that code is just wherever trap returns to. So to enable this, the assembly code that calls trap has a label called trap ret immediately after the call to trap. just so we can insert that address on the stack we're constructing here. So trap ret is just a pointer to the instruction right after call trap in that assembly. So this means when we switch to this, we're going to go from the bottom of the stack down here, and eventually we're going to get to a point where we want to return, and we're going to return back to that code that trap returns to, restore user registers, go back to user mode with those registers. And the code I showed you here doesn't actually put anything in these user registers, but there's some other code that will set up the initial value of the registers the way we want it to be based on the new thread we're starting. So this handles returning from trap, but remember that we actually have a call to switch that we need to simulate. So the next thing we're going to put on here is we're going to simulate a call to switch, and the call to switch is going to happen from somewhere. And there's a special little function called forkret. So it's called forkret because the system call that's used to create a new process is going to be called fork. So forkret is the return part of that. And this contains extra setup code we want to run when we start a new thread. So there's a little extra setup code, and then it returns. So forkret's going to run and then return using this address to trapret. So it's going to return the same place trap would return to. And that's how we're going to start running this new thread in user mode. And this return address to forkret is going to be the return address that switch reads when we switch to this new thread. So switch is going to start with this set of save registers, including the return address. So when we switch to this new stack, it's going to pop those off, load all the registers, pop return using forkret, run the forkret function. The forkret function is going to finish. Then we're going to do the same thing we do if we finished a trap and go back to user mode. And this code here is just setting it up. So the struct context is constructed just to mirror what the switch function expects on the stack, just so we can do this setup here. So we can set EIP to be the return address part of what switch is looking for on the stack. And the rest of that, all those register values it's going to pop are just set to 0 to give them a value. And so this new stack basically is equivalent to, like, we're in the middle of a call to switch that's about to return from a system call. We have the ending part of the fork system call. We'll talk about how the fork system call works a bit later. And that's going to return from trap and then go back to user mode. And so we set up this fake stack. Even though there wasn't a real call to switch, the stack makes it look like there was one, so we can actually use the switch function and have switch return from this fake other call to switch. So any questions about this trick of setting up an initial stack so switch works? Yes?
Is this function called right before switch is called, or right after switch is called?
The question is, when is this function called relative to a call to switch? Well, we're not going to be able to switch to this new kernel stack until it's set up. So it has to be called before. And in XV6, it's kind of decoupled. We first create the process, and then we let it get switched to by just the normal operation of things like the timer expiring and so on. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is our thread setup. So something which shows up here is this p variable, which is a struct proc. And this is a data structure used to represent the information about a process. And in XV6, since every process has exactly one thread, it's also where we have the information about a thread. And a generic term for this is a process control block. So XV6 represents this with struct proc. And why don't we look at what's in a process? We saw that we had a kernel stack for that thread that the process was running. We also have some other information that we keep track of. So one thing we've seen before is that we have the current trap frame for If there's a system call active, this is where we look up the saved user registers. So that's part of the process of state. So if the process isn't running, this might be set, and you can see what the user registers are. If it is running, well, then nothing's going to be in there because the real registers are going to be on the CPU. We also have this struct context, which is the pointer that we're going to use for switch. So this is a pointer, the current kernel stack pointer. If it's not running, if it is running, if you want, it is running, and it's in user mode. Well, there's no current. The current kernel stack pointer is going to the beginning of the kernel stack, and it's not saved there. And if it is running and it's in kernel mode, the current kernel stack pointer is on the CPU. It's not going to be saved here. So this is the stack pointer for switching to this process. We have our kernel stack. We also have information about whether the process is running or not, because we know that like if the process can ask to wait for a key press, and we're going to have some way of remembering that. And in Xv6, we have a state, which can be that the process is starting, is waiting for something, is runnable, but is not on the CPU right now, or is on the CPU right now, or the zombie state we'll talk about later today. We also have some that information kind of scattered about. There's this CHAN variable, which very non-intuitively is how Xv6 remembers if this process is waiting for something, what is it waiting for? Is it waiting for a key press, or is it waiting for like a certain amount of time to pass? Is it waiting for the hard drive? Xv6 remembers that with the CHAN variable. And there's this killed variable, which we saw briefly, which is just, is this process in the process of being killed? Should be, you know, if it starts running, should it just exit? Now, I talked about killing processes, and that's an operation you can ask the operating system to do to another process, but we need some way of identifying processes. So the way Xv6 does that is it has a process ID field. This PID. And this is used just to identify processes and system calls as a way that user programs can pass around PIDs and the system can know how to interpret them. We also have information about the program's memory. In Xv6, this is represented in two ways. First, we have the view of how much memory does the program have allocated. The way Xv6 lays out the program's memory, it gets address 0 to the end of its heap. So SC is where the end of its heap is. That tells how much memory is active. But that's not the information the processor needs. The processor needs to know the mapping from program addresses to real addresses. And that's stored in a page table, and page dir is a pointer to that page table. We also need to know about open files. So there's this array, ofile, which we'll talk about next time, of open files, which has, in Xv6's case, has a maximum number of entries. If you want more files, too bad. And there's also, we need to track the current directory the program is in, so that's a separate element as part of the process's state. So these are all things that are tracked by the in our process control block, all information that the kernel needs to track about a process. And it would vary between OS, and these are common things you'll see on lots of OSs. So we have this structure which tracks the information about the process. We need some way of getting it. And we've already seen that when we looked at the code to trap and for system call handling, there's this myproc function, and that just retrieves a pointer to the currently running struct proc. So one question you might have is, how do we figure out what struct proc is currently running? So Xv6's solution to this is to use global variables. Now, Xv6 supports multi-core, so we can't just use one global variable. So instead, there's an array with one entry for every possible core, and CPU is just the maximum number of cores Xv6 supports. And the myproc function calls this myCPU function to get an entry of that array, the struct CPU, which is the per core information, And it figures out what index to use based on a special register which says, which core are we on? And from that, it retrieves a proc pointer that's stored in there. Now, you might say, how is that set? So part of doing the context switch that I didn't talk about, but it is actually very important, is that we're going to change that proc pointer before we do call switch, or immediately after, one of the two. And that's just so my proc works. Yes?
Could you just explain one more time how the ID register works?
This question is, how does the ID register work? So every core has their own set of registers, and this is going to be a special, basically, read-only register that's going to be different on each core just to help operating systems work on a multi-core system. Yes?
How is the MyCPU function implemented?
What? Question is, how is the MyCPU function implemented? So the MyCPU function uses some probably assembly, I don't actually remember, uses some way to retrieve this special what core ID register, and uses that as an index into the CPU's array, and returns a pointer to that. Other questions? Yes. So there's a global variable called CPUs, which is just an array of these struct CPUs. I should have probably pointed that out more prominently. So that's a global variable declared somewhere. Other questions? OK. So for the rest of today and also Thursday, we're going to go to a higher level and talk about things from the perspective of the programming interface. We're going to focus on what Unix systems do in general and how we deal with processes in them. You might say, why are we talking about Unix? So there's a couple reasons. So one is we have source code. Like, we have XV6, we have Linux source code if we want to find out how something really works. And it's just a little harder to do that with Windows. Also, you're kind of maybe possibly used to it from 2150, so it seems like a reasonable point. And it's been around for a while, and, well, XV6 imitates it, so it's what we're going to talk about, even though we're going to talk about a bunch of things that XV6 doesn't implement all these features, because it's sort of a simplified Unix. And I'd say, so I've said Unix, and I said Unix-like OSs. So why are all these OSs kind of having the same sort of general interface that I can call a whole bunch of OSs Unix-likes? Where does that come from? Well, there was an original OS that was made at AT&T in 69, and some later versions of it were called Unix. So we had, up until 73, we had Unix versions 1 through 4, then 5 and 6, and this is what XV6 is based on. And we have a whole bunch of derivatives. And the ones where you see lines connecting them, there's actually source code being shared. So there were a whole bunch of operating systems that were popular in the 80s or 90s, including many commercial operating systems, that were all based on this common ancestor operating system, Unix. And in many cases, actually shared source code from the original version of Unix built at AT&T in the 60s and 70s. There's also Linux here and Minix. And notice that these don't have lines. So they imitate Unix, but they don't actually share source code. They just have the same interface. But there's this wide family of Unix-like operating systems, which were, at one point, many of them were popular. And they were obviously extremely influential. Now, one thing that happens when you have so many different operating systems is that, well, let's say you're a company making business software, in 1990, and you want to sell to people who have a Next Step machine, or a SunOS machine, or a Solaris machine, or an AIX machine, or an HPUX machine, the same piece of software. And that seems like a lot of work. You need to port your software to 5 different commercially popular OSs. And people who are making operating systems recognize this as a problem. So after Unix sort of splintered out like this, and each version of Unix, each variant of Unix was sort of doing different things, the makers of these different versions of Unix came together and made POSIX, the Portable Operating System Interface. And basically the purpose of POSIX was to standardize a Unix that everyone would actually implement, but it's not standardized from a perspective of here's how you have to build the kernel and all that. It's standardized to make it possible for those people making applications to produce one application that actually they can build on everything. And it's focused on source compatibility. So the idea is that I write this application once, then I get an HP UX machine and an AIX machine. I build and compile it on that, have my HP UX version, build and compile on AIX, I have my AIX version, and so on. But I can keep all the source code the same and have everything basically work. At least that's the theory. And POSIX has actually been updated up until this year. It's still being updated. And most modern Unix-like OSs try to follow what this standard says. So Linux and OS X all try to implement some version of the standard. Those are two modern Unix-like OSs. You can see Linux on this chart down here. This is OS X down here, which actually, yes, shares some source code with something which shared source code with the original Unix. So they all try to follow it, so it's a useful thing to know about. But because POSIX is based on being compatible, what it specifies is the library and shell interface for source code compatibility. So it says if you write this C code, you'll be able to compile it. If you run these shell commands, they'll work. That's what it specifies. It doesn't care about how it's implemented. So even though the original Unix, like certain things were system calls, POSIX doesn't say anything needs to be a system call. It doesn't say system calls need to exist. It just says there's a library function you can call, and it does this. And probably, for many of those library functions, everyone implements it by just making a system call, but that's not required. Not actually specified, because that doesn't matter for can I take my application and compile it here. It also doesn't specify binary format, so you can't produce an executable on one POSIX system and use it on another. That's not something that they could get agreement on. So questions on POSIX? Okay, so I'm going to talk for probably the rest of the day about the functions that the POSIX provides for process management. And in a typical implementation, all these functions will end up being system calls. But that's, as I said, not actually required. And I'm going to talk about a subset of them. There's a lot more, but talk about, you know, a useful, interesting subset. So there's some functions to get information about a process. So maybe the simplest one is get PID. So we talked about we have this PID idea that is a way of referring to a particular process in a system call. And we need some way to get them. And get PID gets you your own PID. So you call get PID, it returns an integer that has a type PIDT. I'm just casting it here because I'm not sure what type it is for the purposes of printf, and I want to print along and hopefully make sure it works. So it just returns your current process's PID. And you might say, what about other processes' PID? Well, if you're working manually, you can use the PS command, and it gives you other processes' IDs. There's other options you can supply to PS to get more. You might say, what about from a C program? Well, if you started the process, we'll have a solution for you. If you didn't, POSIX doesn't help you very much. POSIX's best solution is basically run PS and figure it out. So that's simple getting process, the idea of your process, which other of these process management functions like wait or kill will need. Then we have to talk about creating processes. And something that you might think is a bit weird here is I have process creation separate from running programs. And you might think that's the same thing. And well, you're not silly. POSIX has decided to separate these two operations. So we're going to talk about process creation, and then we'll talk about running programs. And obviously, there's going to be some interaction, but these are going to be separated. And the way of creating processes in POSIX, the primary way, is with the fork function. And what the fork function does is it copies the current process. And because it copies the current process, this means it's going to return twice. It's going to return in the original, and well, the copy, when the copy is made, it has all its user registers about to return from fork. So that's going to return too. And the way you can tell, am I in the original process or the new one, is by the return value of fork. That will set it up so the new process, which we'll call the child, is going to have a return value of 0, and the parent's return value is going to be the PID of the new child process. And that's really handy, because otherwise it would be actually pretty hard for us to figure out what the process ID we just created was. And we're going to duplicate everything but the PID in the child from the parent. And this includes the contents of memory. This is a deep copy. We're not going to share like stacks. We're going to copy the stack. We're not going to share registers. We're going to copy the registers. So we can kind of look at this as here I have my process control block. I have my user registers. I have a pointer to a kernel stack. I have a pointer to my stack heap, global variables, and so on, all the memory I can access. I have my open files, which we'll talk about a lot more on Thursday, some other information, process ID, current working directory, and so on. And the first thing fork is going to do is it's going to make a copy of this, the whole thing. And we're not going to be satisfied with this. We're not going to make a shallow copy like this. We're going to make a deep copy. So we're also going to copy all the memory. And we might do something, XV6, it turns out, does something a little different with how the new kernel stack is, but the memory, all copied. All the user memory, stack heap, so on, we get a new version, copied. And then we have to deal with, well, we're going to return a different PID in, sorry, return a different value in the child and the parent, so we have to make that happen. So in X86, the return value is probably going to be in the EAX register. So after we make this copy, we can edit the EAX register and the parent and child to make that happen. In the parent, we tell it what the child's PID is. In the child, we return 0 just as a marker to say, you aren't the parent. Some questions about this process? Yes?
Is doing a deep copy something specified in POSIX, or is it just XV6?
The question is this a deep copy specified in POSIX? POSIX specifies that it's a deep copy, at least from the perspective of it has to act as if it's a deep copy. So as we'll talk about later in the semester, high-quality implementations of fork typically do something that avoids doing all this copying, but they're going to behave as if they actually do this copy. This is the interface we provide, is as if we actually copy all the user data. Other questions? Okay, so I have fork here, a fork example here. So here I have a program. We first get our PID and print it out just for information. Then we call fork. And remember, fork's going to return twice. So we're going to get this child PID variable. And if we're in the parent, that's going to be the actual PID of the new process. And if we're in the child, it's going to be 0. So I check if it's greater than 0. If it is, we must be in the parent. So I get my PID again, which should be the same as here. And I print out the my PID and the child PID. And in the child, here I print out my new PID. I also have an else case, so fork can fail. So one example is, let's say we're out of memory. We were doing that copy and we ran out of memory. We're not going to crash. We're going to return an error from fork. And the way fork indicates an error, it returns a PID of -1. Tell you something went wrong, like we ran out of space. So in that case here, I have a call to p-error, and p-error is going to print fork failed colon, and then an error message based on the last error code, which is stored in a variable known as erno. So it's going to print out the error message corresponding to an error code that was written into erno to tell us what went wrong. Yes? So the question is, how exactly does the returning twice work? So when we make this fork system call, part of our user registers that are saved is going to be the next PC. And that's here. Okay. And that's going to be pointing here, right? So we're going to copy that. So we're going to have two copies with both point there. So when we run the first, we're going to start running there. When we run the We're going to have two copies of the process, the original and the copy, and the new one. When the original keeps running, it's going to start there. When the new one keeps running, we copy that saved program counter, it's going to run there. So we end up running that code twice, once in the original, once in the copy.
So are you saying fork is actually called twice?
So the question is, fork is actually called, fork is called once and returns twice.
Okay.
Because make the copy after calling it.
Right. But by the two processes, it means a parent and a child process.
The question is, by the two processes, it means parent and child? Yes, those are the two relevant processes here.
Okay. So there's actually two threads running. Like,
so the question is, there are two threads? Yes. Okay. With their own stack and their own heap and their own globals, their own everything. So when this runs, let's say our parent has process ID 100. So one possible thing that could happen is we have our call to fork. The parent prints out 100 here. Then we have the fork call returns first, let's say, in the parent and goes into here. And the parent does this print and then exits. And then we have our call to fork in the child. Goes through here, does this print, and then exits. Yes?
One error process calls fork like multiple times. Do all the child processes get a process ID of 0?
The question is, one parent process calls fork multiple times. Do all the child processes get 0? Yes. The return value of fork tells you what happened in this call to fork. Are you the parent of this call to fork or the child of this call to fork? The question is, so if I call fork multiple times, how do I differentiate them? Well, hopefully you stored the process IDs somewhere so you can remember which is which. And you would store them because you got them from fork and you just could write them into an array, for example. Yes?
In that case, would the process ID of the parent be the one of the last child that you copied?
So the question is, if I call fork multiple times, wouldn't the process ID, you're saying when I have like a child of a child. So this depends where I call fork from. So the situation I think he was referring to is I have one parent process that's running, and it calls fork to make a child process, calls fork to make another child process, and we have three programs running at once, both of which were made from the same parent process. So it's also possible to do something where you call fork, make a child process, and that child process makes a child process, in which case things would be different. But those are two different things you can do. Yes?
What if you have a memory-intensive parent process, and you want to create a new process that does something that doesn't really require a lot of memory, is there a way to not use all the memory?
So the question is, gosh, fork seems very wasteful. What if, this is too much space? And so there going to be two answers for that. So we're going to talk about, after we talk about running programs, we're going to talk about, you know, alternatives to fork. Another answer is that the actual implementation of this copy, the copy of the memory, is going to be something that's going to, it turns out, is going to avoid actually doing the copy if you don't need it, but still appear to do the copy. And we'll talk about that basically around the time of the midterm. But there's some way of like speeding that up, but it's going to appear as if we do the copy. And we'll actually do the copy, of course, if you actually use that memory. But yes, it's a good question, because right now it seems like if I have like a program, like my browser using 2 gigs of RAM, it seems like how can it start another program, you know, without me running out of memory? Okay. Other questions? Okay. Yeah.
In the text box that you had that showed the output.
Yeah.
Is it guaranteed that the parent will exit fork first?
The question is: guaranteed that the parent will exit fork first? Absolutely not. Yes. Question is, does fork trigger a context switch? No. Fork is not required to trigger a context switch. It may or may not. Yeah.
As far as what the PIDs will be, is there generally some, are they normally getting close together?
The question is, how are the PIDs chosen? So POSIX doesn't specify anything. It just says, that's a number, it's going to be greater than 0. It probably specifies that it's not going to be 1. But other than that, tells you nothing. In practice, the two common schemes are that it's going to be sequential, but avoiding duplicates. So there's wraparound, and we won't like reassign the same PID twice at the same time, or random. And those are the two schemes I've seen. Yeah.
That also means that, so there's a limited number of processes you can have.
Question is, there's a limited number of processes you can have? Yes. So. And typically, PIDs in a modern system are going to be 32 or 64 bits, which, so historically they might have been 16 bits, but typically in a modern system they're like at least 24 bits, so you're likely to run out of memory instead of running out of processes. But indeed, yes, that could be a limit if we run out of IDs. Other questions? Okay, so since we looked at fork, someone mentioned that, does the parent have to run first? And the answer is no. So with that in mind, give me two possible outputs of this. As a hint, there are more than two possible outputs. You can check with your neighbor to see if you agree.
Society. Yeah.
Okay, so can someone give me one possible output? And just one, anyone. It's a thing, yes.
In child and child 100.
So in child, then what?
Child 100.
And child 100. Okay. Anything else? Note that there's a printf here. And done. And done again. That you said, and done again?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I agree. This is a possible output. Now, some of you might look at this and say, what? So what happened here to make this output? Or if you're, or can you, first, we'll talk about like how, why is that possible? First, yeah. First, like another possible output? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying we could, that we said that the order could differ. Okay, how about another one? Yeah, back there.
Is child 100 done and child 100?
Child 100 done in child done. Yes, that is also possible. Yeah.
Is any arrangement of them possible?
Question is any arrangement of them possible?
If child 100. So like, because it could start with child 100 and then switch to the other process in child done.
Yes. So your question is any possible as long as that the first done is after one of these and the second done is after both of them? And that is true. Yes. So all the possibilities, as long as we have, because the way we can think about it is we have in child and done and child 100 done, and we go down both of these at once, and we can take any order. And the reason we can take any order is because the OS, it can start and stop running these based on a timer, so that could happen like any time depending on how fast things are running. So we can get various interleavings, just that we always run each thing in order, and the child is going to run this and then this, and the parent is going to run this and then this, and we just need to preserve that ordering. Yes. Can we have child negative one and then done? So, yeah. So if fork failed, that's what we expect the output to be. And a better version of this code would check for negative one explicitly. I was trying to get rid of that possibility with assume no crashes, etc., but that's not unambiguous. Another thing you might imagine might happen is you could have guessed that because we can have things interleave, that maybe a possible output would be child and then in child 100, because like the printf gets interrupted in the middle and things like that. Because they're both running at the same time and the OS can switch whenever it wants. And it's based on a timer, so it's like kind of random in practice. Okay, so that gives us this. So questions on how he came up with those possibilities? So on. And also another thing to emphasize is that you notice that this done was run in both the parent and the child. If we didn't want to get run in both of them, We should have put an exit here and or here. Okay. Questions? Yes.
There isn't a context switch happening between parent and child, right?
Question, there isn't a
context switch.
What do you mean? Isn't a context switch happening between parent and child when?
Like in the diagram below, the spaces between, that's, I was just confused that you mentioned that fork doesn't do a context switch.
So fork doesn't itself guarantee do a context switch, but the OS can do a context switch based on a timer, which could happen at any time.
Okay.
And fork is allowed to do a context switch, but there's no requirement. But and because the OS can switch on a timer, like you couldn't know whether fork sometimes did a context switch, because it could just be the case that you got lucky and it and a timer happened right after you called fork, and you know that made it do a context switch in that case. Yes.
So is there the same way you can like lock a thread and like or have a thread wait? Is that possible for processes as well?
Question, is it possible for processes to wait? And the answer is going to be yes. And we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So first, we're going to talk about writing programs. So I talked about creating new processes. But all the processes we created are running the same program we were already running, which turns out is often not so useful. So our assignment next week is going to be making a shell. And one of the things your shell needs to do is that you like type the name of a program, like say ls, the file listing program. And you expect to run the file listing program and not the shell. And fork doesn't do that. Fork makes a process in which we could run the file listing program, but it doesn't actually start the file listing program. And in POSIX, they've decided that there's a separate function for starting a new program. And this doesn't create a new process. Instead, it replaces the currently running program in the current process with a new program. So same process control block. We just set the process control block's values for a new program. So I wrote exec star because there's a whole bunch of functions whose names start with exec. We'll just talk specifically about exec v, but there's a bunch of similar things that all just replace the current program with a new one in the same process. And the first argument to exec is the path to the executable file to run. And second argument is an array of arguments. And this becomes exactly what argv is in main. It's just copied into there. No interpretation happens. It just becomes argv. The way we know what program to run is with the path argument. And because this is just a pointer to an array of strings, we have to know where the end is. That's indicated with a null string pointer. Because there's nothing in the prototype which tells us how big the array is. And typically, we're going to use this exec function with fork because we usually, but not always, want to run the new program in a different process. Because with a shell, for example, I type ls, enter, I want to run the file listing program, but after it finishes, I still want the shell to be running. And the way we can arrange that, because ls is not going to help us, is by keeping the shell running in a parent process and running the file listing program in a child process. And when that child process exits, we still have the parent process around to like ask for the next command and so on. So here's an example call to execv. So I fork, and in the child process, I have my arguments array terminated by a null, so it knows how many arguments there are. And this is going to match what's in going to be passed to main. A convention in POSIX is that argv of 0 is the name of the program being run. This is a convention in the sense that ls is going to look there to see what its name is. But POSIX doesn't actually like interpret exec v's arguments. It just gives them to the main function. So this is equivalent to the command ls minus l that you might run from the command line. And we have to say what executable to run. And on a typical Unix-like system, the file listing executable is going to be in the slash bin directory, which is why I wrote slash bin slash ls. So that's our path to the executable. And that's just, this is just happens to be where the file listing program is located. We can't just write ls. That doesn't specify which particular ls file we want to use, which contains the compiled program. So something you might see after exec, it replaces the current process. And that means that when it works correctly, it doesn't return. It doesn't return because it's running, in this case, ls's main function. And when ls's main function finishes, it's going to exit that new process. There's not that new process, the current process. We're not going to go back. We don't even remember the old state. We're going to replace it. So if execv works, it doesn't return. So all this code I have after execv is saying, well, if I got here, something went wrong. Maybe binls doesn't exist. Maybe I ran out of memory. But something went wrong. So I'm going to try to print an error and then exit so my parent process can maybe figure out what went on. Questions about this code? Yes.
Wait, did you say why does the bin ls need ls as an argument? So, like, does it do anything with that ls argument?
The question is, does bin ls do anything with that ls argument? So, and why does it need it as an arg? So, one reason it's needed as an arg is because the convention is that we pass the name of the program first. It's going to look for other arguments like minus l starting with index 1, not index 0. As for does it do anything with this, typically it's going to use it to like format error messages, like ls colon file not found. But that's just typical. It's not required to do that. Yeah?
If for some reason there wasn't a null terminator in the args list, would that throw an exception inside the exec process and then not run that PR command? Or that?
So the question is, what happens if I don't have a null here? And and from a POSIX point of view, it's undefined behavior. Anything could happen. It could sec fault or something. Typically, the execv will return an error. In either case, it's not something you want to do. Okay. Other questions? Or I guess I should be more specific. I said it typically will return an error. Sometimes it will. There will be other stuff in memory after there, and those will be added as arguments, and who knows what will happen. That's probably maybe a more common case, unfortunately, for people in the shell assignment. Okay, so using our process control block view, we have our process control block, and when we call exec, we're going to allocate memory for the new program and change the process control block to point to that. And also change all the registers to be set up to start running this new program. So we're going to change our PC, our stack pointer, and so on to all point to how this LS program expects to start. And we're also going to load the program from its executable file. Now, we have to deal with somehow getting the arguments into the program. So generally, part of loading the program is that we're going to copy the arguments, usually onto the new program stack. And we need to copy them because once we set up this new program to run, you know, we don't have anything actually using this memory anymore, so we're going to actually get rid of that. So we make a copy of the arguments so that we can keep them around. And one thing to notice here is that I changed the memory of the program and the user registers. We're not going to change a bunch of other things in the process control block, notably including the open files. So this means, for example, that if my program is set up to write to my terminal and I call exec, that new program is still set up to write to my terminal. It's going to have all the open files available. We'll talk about how those exactly work next time. But this is useful because this means that, you know, we can figure out what the program is going to output to and change that just by opening files normally. And this gets to, like, why are we doing fork exec? You know, we could just have a function that just creates a process running a particular program. And in fact, this is a common implementation choice. So on Windows, there's no fork exec. There's a create process function, which creates a new process running a particular program. And POSIX, relatively recently, like 2000s, added a POSIX spawn, which does the same sort of thing. Now, the reason why fork exec is often regarded as an elegant solution is because with an API like create process, we need to set up all the state of the new process. Let's say I want to run ls in a particular directory. Well, then I need to change to that directory. With fork and exec, I fork, change to that directory, exec. If I want to do that with create process, hopefully create process has a way of letting me specify the directory. Let's say I want to run ls outputting to a particular place or getting input from a particular place, then I need to open that file for it and have it be reading or writing from that. With fork and exec, I fork, do that file open, exec, and everything's set up. With create process, I better hope I can supply an argument to create process that makes this happen. That's sort of the advantage. And if you look at the create process call in Windows or the POSIX spawn call, there are a bunch of extra arguments to handle that. There's alternate ways. You could have an API to have a process that's not running yet and change what it has open and so on. But having fork in general avoids just needing to have a way to manipulate other processes, because you can just have run code that actually does that manipulation. But the disadvantage, of course, is we're doing this copy operation. And from a high level, the copy operation seems ridiculous. If my program has a gigabyte of memory, I'm going to copy all of that just so it can do the work of running execv. That's what it seems like we're doing right now. And even with some tricks to make that copying a lot less bad, that's pretty expensive. And in fact, it's pretty expensive enough that there's sort of things which are in between fork and this sort of create process or POSIX spawn that have existed in Unix likes for a while, just to be a little faster. So you might say, I talked about, we have these other APIs, so what might that look like? So I'll show you an example of POSIX spawn. So in POSIX spawn, it returns an error code, or zero if there's no error. And we have a pointer to where to store the new PID, we have the program to run, we have the arguments, and we have a bunch of extra arguments for, like, what do I want the open files to be? Which, with fork and exec, we just open and close files after forking before execing. This is a replacement for that. What do I want things like current directory and some other settings to be? We have settings for that because we can't change it before execing, because this call does both of those together. And also environment variables, which we'll maybe mention briefly later. So you have all these specified separately. Now, you might say, well, that's a little awkward, but this seems like the thing we should use if you say, like, it avoids the copy. I have some bad news about how this is implemented. So POSIX spawn, I mentioned, was added in, the 90s, early 1000s, probably early 1000s, and the typical implementation is that, well, they didn't change the kernel. They just wrote POSIX spawn in terms of a fork-like function, typically something slightly more efficient than fork, called vfork, and exec. So it still does basically the same thing internally in most implementations. Obviously, a better implementation wouldn't do that, but because they were working with an operating system designed to use fork and exec, that's not how most Unix operating systems have implemented this. And on some of them, it's not implemented because they don't conform to that version of POSIX. But this is sort of what an API that doesn't do copying would do. And, as I said, there's some advantages to that. In fact, there's some people who are pretty vocal that this shouldn't happen. So this is a paper from the workshop on Hot Topics and Operating System from last year. And some very prominent people write that fork was a clever hack for machines and programs of the 1970s that has long outlived its usefulness and is now a liability. But, if only because Unix was so dominant and in fact, is the basis for lots of current operating systems. We're kind of stuck with that today, even if perhaps in retrospect, maybe it wasn't the best choice, though it has people who think it is elegant in terms of how it lets you set up the new process, and its implementation is not that hard, and so on. So questions about fork and exec? Yeah.
So it looks like with the bin ls, it's kind of hard coded. Like, you're getting the args, like the user input is telling you like ls -l, but then in the code.
So the question is, how do we find that it's /bin ls and not something else? So we'll in POSIX systems, there's something called an environment variable associated with the process. One of these is called the path, and the convention is that contains a list of directories to check. And a shell will typically look for the first place which has a particular executable name. Also, there is actually a variant of exec and POSIX spawn which search that path themselves. For the shell, we're going to have you implement. We're just not going to have you implement that, and we're just going to have the user type /bin/ls, just to make things simpler for you. Yes.
How is the child PID actually given from the parent?
Question is, how does the parent get the child PID?
No. How does it get assigned? Because isn't it zero? Like for the child, like after you call board.
So the question is, isn't it zero? So the child gets a return value here of 0 in the child, but remember the child has its own registers and its own stack. So that 0 doesn't affect what the parent gets for that, because the parent has that stored separately. And we deliberately store different values in the parent and the child's register for that return value.
Like after?
During the fork system call, before we let the child start running. Yes.
So in the child process when it's copied, it will be pointing to that next instruction, which is the beginning of that if statement.
Question is, when the child process gets copied, it points to the beginning of this statement? Yes. And before we start running the child, we'll set the child PID register to 0 in the child and to the new PID in the parent. Other questions? So one process management function that we need to get to is waiting for processes to finish. So I talked about we would do this fork and exec in our shell to run ls, because after ls finishes, we want to print a prompt and get the next command. And notice I said after ls finishes. We don't want to do it while ls is running. We want to wait for ls to finish. So we need some way of doing that. And the main way in POSIX that we're going to talk about is wait PID. If you look this up, you'll find out that there's a family of wait functions, kind of like there's a family of exec functions. I'm going to just talk about wait PID because it's probably the most convenient. So wait PID takes a bunch of arguments. It has a PID of the program we want to wait for. It has a pointer to where you want to store the status of the program, which is information about how did it finish. And it also has options. We're going to use typically 0 for no options. Most notably, you can set options to, instead of waiting, to just see did it finish now or not. But typically, we'll just pass 0 to just wait for this program normally. And it returns the PID you waited for, or -1 if there's an error. And as a special case, you can pass a PID of -1, in which case you say, if I forked multiple times from the same process, wait for any of those children. And just tell me the first one that finishes. Yes?
Is there some sort of time limit, or is that right off?
The question is there some sort of time limit? There is not. So, so you might ask, how can I wait with a time limit? It turns out, you would think there would be a variant of wait PID, but typically not. Typically, the way of doing that involves the something called signals, and it's probably a topic that I can't go over in enough detail. But there is a way of doing that, but it's does not involve a variant of this to do the wait for a particular wait with a time limit part. But we do use that, still use this and that solution to get the exit status and actually verify it finished correctly. So you might say, well, we have this exit status, what does that mean? And most obviously, it refers to, well, the exit status you return like for main. If you return 0 for main or exit 0, 0 is your exit code. And that's part of the information we'll get in there. It's also going to encode information about, well, did the program terminate normally or not? And that means it's not just going to be a copy of what you returned for main or what you passed to exit. And we'll show that in a bit. So our typical use of wait PID is we're going to fork, and in the parent process, we're going to wait PID on the child with a particular status. This assumes that we want to not do anything else in our parent program until the new thing we're running finishes. If we wanted to do other things, we wouldn't wait right away. And in this case, I'm just discarding the status, but you might want to figure out, well, what happened in the child process. And because the status information encodes both whether the process terminated normally or not, and its exit code, you can't just read it directly. So POSIX provides a bunch of back rows which start with a capital W. One of them is if exited. So if that's true, then the program terminated by calling exit or returning from main instead of doing something like having a seg fault or you typing control C. And in that case, you can retrieve its exit status, which is the value that was returned from main or passed to exit. The other notable option is a program can be signaled. So signals are a way of communicating to processes. And you might say, how does that have to do anything with terminating processes? So when your program accesses invalid memory, what POSIX maps that to is that the kernel will send a signal to your process that, hey, you accessed invalid memory. And you could have set up something to handle that and do something in response to that. But if you don't, the default behavior is your process gets killed. And if it's signaled, you can retrieve the number of the signal, which is a constant in one of several constants. So talk about signals. So for example, sig segv is the constant for the segmentation fault signal. So when you run a program in your shell and it finishes and you see the message segmentation fault, what actually happens is your shell called wait PID on the program, and it got back that it was signaled, and the signal that was used was the sig segv signal. This is an integer constant, and the shell printed out the message segmentation fault. And for another example is sigint. That's the constant for control C. So you could set up something to handle control C, in which case it wouldn't exit immediately from that. But the default is it exits, and the parent process could look up why and would find out, oh, it was the control C thing. And there's a bunch of others, you know, other possible signals which ordinarily terminate programs. Right, you can retrieve that information, and that's encoded in the status, and that means you can't just read, you know, the return value from main directly out of there, because it's either that or the signal information. So questions about decoding exit statuses? Okay. So I mentioned when I talked about wait PID, that wait PID can take arguments that, you know, indicate any process. So one thing you can do is, even if you didn't track what processes you started, you can wait for everything by just calling it over and over again until it doesn't return an error. Because it will return an error if there's nothing to wait for. Now, our typical pattern with wait PID is that we're going to fork, we're going to have our child process exec something, and when that finishes, it's going to exit. You know, and maybe we'll have cases where we don't exec, we do something else, but this is our typical pattern, and we'll call wait PID. And wait PID is going to sit around until that exit happens, and that exit is going to trigger wait PID to actually return sometime later. This is typically what we expect. Now, wait PID doesn't actually care whether or not it's called before or after the child processes finishes. So for example, let's say I get unlucky and my parent process runs really slow or is doing other things before it waits. That's fine. The child process could have exited already, in which case when we call wait PID, it will return right away, figuring out, oh, it already exited. And this means to make this work that when a process has exited but not been waited for, the kernel needs to keep around information about that process ID so wait PID can work. Yes?
How long does this child process stay around?
Question, how long does this child process stay around? Until you call wait PID, or there's no way for you to do so. Yes?
So which processes the children of other processes kept track of by DLS?
Question is, which processes the which is parent and child? Yes, and I'll talk about that, how that exactly works a bit later. Yes? Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, when both the programs are running, it's switching back and forth. Assuming we have one core, yes. If we have multiple cores, maybe they're even running at the same time. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So in code, you know, our pattern would be we call fork. In the child, we call exec that runs the main of some other program. And then that finishes, and the parent, we would call wait PID to not proceed in the parent until then. Now, in this pattern, we're starting a program, waiting for it to finish. We can also do something, and this might come up in the shell assignment, like starting a bunch of programs and then waiting for them all. And that's perfectly fine because it doesn't matter, you know, we can wait any time afterwards as long as we, you know, it's, yeah. Until it finishes. So in this case, you know, I'm saying fork a bunch of times, start a child process and exec in that, and in the parent, just remember the PIDs to wait for it later. And this is why wait PID takes a PID argument, because we can have multiple child processes and we could care about which one we're waiting for. And we could also do a variant of this where we say wait for them in the order they finish instead of in the order that we started them. And both will work equally well because the OS will keep information around until we call wait. So it doesn't matter if we do it out of order or in order. Okay. So someone asked, you know, like, does this mean the operating system needs to remember the parent of every process? Yes. So every process has a parent process except for process ID 1, the first process. And we can retrieve that with the getPPID function, in fact. So it's definitely tracked. And this is the only process that can wait for it. And because every process is a parent process, except for one, this actually forms a tree of processes starting with process one that every system is in. And this small output here is the output of a command called pstree, which just reads all the process IDs and parent process IDs and outputs them as a tree. Now, you might say there are a few situations we didn't mention how they were handled. So one question is, what if the parent exits before the child? Doesn't wait for it, just exits. What's going to happen? And the rule in POSIX is that we still want the child to have a parent process. So it becomes process ID 1, which is typically called init. And typical implementations of that first process will, after it starts everything, will wait for processes to finish and maybe print a message about them, maybe not. You might ask, what if the parent never wait PIDs and it just keeps running? Well, the child process is going to stay around, and what's known as a zombie, that's what the zombie state was for, so we're going to keep track of it and reserve its PID. We have to reserve its PID because it would be really bad if we called wait PID and we didn't know whether we were waiting for the first process with that PID or the second. So we have to make sure we never reuse the PID until it's waited for, because the OS doesn't know that the parent process won't eventually call wait PID. And if a non-parent tries to wait PID, wait PID is going to fail. It's going to return an error. You're just not allowed to do that. Okay, so questions? Yes. Okay, so I guess we're less on time than before. And there's two other process functions I'll just mention that I don't think need much explanation. There's exit, we've already seen. And kill is just make another process terminate. Okay, that's where I'll finish up today.